Being a good parent isn't just about having a set of skills or knowing the right thing to do all the time. Ask any good parent you know. They can tell you their pro tips, but most are happy to admit that a lot of parenting feels like winging it. Who we are and how we continue to grow matters because our kids pick up most of what they learn from us by watching how we do things, not by listening to our instructions. So join me on this journey of remodeling our mindsets so that our actions speak to those watching. I'm Dr. Dina Shelton, and this is Remodel Parenting. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Lessons from Classic Research and Remodel Parenting Podcast. Today, I'm talking about Jane Elliott's Divided Classroom Experiment. Now, this one is an interesting as well. The last one I said in my disclaimer and preparation to listen that it was a bit of a different scenario, and now I'm bringing in another one that's also different. This psychological experiment was not started as a psychological experiment. Jane Elliott was a teacher in the 1960s, and she actually started this as a classroom activity and exercise. But the results of it were so significant, and she continued it in her classrooms, that it was picked up not only as an experiment that taught us something about how racism and prejudice and other types of feelings and behaviors in people are influenced by what others tell them, it also became a pattern for some trainings and some other things throughout the 90s and 2000s. This study is fascinating to me and has been fascinating me since I was a child. In 1992, Oprah Winfrey had Jane Elliott as a guest on her show to discuss this experiment, and it was nearly 25 years after the first time she did it. I saw this episode as a child. I don't know if I saw it when it first aired, but I don't know if I was saw it the year that it actually was filmed, but I remember seeing it as a child before I was a teenager, and I was struck by what she had done, and it changed me. It changed how I saw the world, even as a child. Elliott was a teacher in 1968 when Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. She was teaching in a small town in Iowa, and she had a full class of children in third grade, and all of the children in her class were white. Now, they had recently named Martin Luther King Jr. as their hero of the month. The day after he was shot and killed, the children came to school and they were so confused and upset and could not understand why someone would want to kill him. Jane Elliott, as their teacher, wanted to explain and help them understand prejudice and racism as a result or as the root of what was going on. But explaining that to third graders is difficult. You guys have heard me on here talk a lot about cognitive development and the ability for kids to get abstract concepts. You really don't have the ability to fully understand those until your brain has developed far past elementary school. But we do have the ability to understand through experience and exposure. She knew that. So she decided to do a little activity and divided her classroom into two groups. And she used a physical indicator. So she divided her kids into blue-eyed children and brown-eyed children. She then decided to conduct a two-day activity that really became more of an experiment than just a classroom experience for the kids. On the first day, she told the blue-eyed kids that they were smarter, nicer, cleaner, and better than brown-eyed children. She praised them. She gave them extra privileges and preferential treatment, like being chosen to do things in class, being line leaders, extra recess. The brown-eyed children were more harshly criticized for their work. They were not allowed the same privileges as the blue-eyed kids. And she discouraged the kids from interacting with people who weren't like them. She told the whole class that blue-eyed people were superior and singled out individual brown-eyed students to call out their bad behavior and assigned it as common to those with brown eyes. The shocking results was a nearly immediate change in the children's interactions with each other. The blue-eyed kids performed better academically. So all of them, she saw this shift in their ability and their academic outpouring when they were told they were smarter and superior. And they began to bully the brown-eyed students, be mean and rude, and did not treat them as well or as much like people as they had before. The brown-eyed students showed significantly less confidence and worse academic performance. And so their academic performance changed as well. Now, the next day, she switched the message and said, gave the same, you know, information that brown-eyed people were superior to those with blue eyes. They were smarter and cleaner and better at everything, and gave the same instructions and just shifted everything. And she watched the dynamic happen and everything reversed. And so even having experienced it the first day as being the kids who were on the low end or the inferior end, that didn't change how they interacted when they were told they were superior and were better than those with blue eyes. At the end of the second day, when the experiment was over, the children were so relieved and they embraced each other. And they said they were so thankful that it was done. And they grasped and understood prejudice and discrimination in a different way. And there's actually a lot of really interesting stuff on this particular activity, because Elliot repeated this in her classroom for years afterwards. It became an awareness training for adults, and she taught it with some prison guards and saw shifts in the behaviors of adults when the lines were drawn in the same way related to eye color. And so it wasn't just children who took this in. When she did the same thing with adults, she saw the same type of behaviors change in full-grown people. Now, you can watch more about this. I do want to tell you, you can go find more information about this, because I think the third year that she did this, they actually brought cameras into the classroom. And there's a lot of real and raw footage of these kids, and the parents were approving of it because it was such an impactful and influential experience for all of them in this community and for their children. And so there's a lot to be watched. It's really interesting. And I think that there's, you know, several news stories, extended news stories, documentaries, and things like that. Now, this classroom activity turned into a psychological experiment because it holds so much for us, so much information to balance as adult, especially in our own mentalities and in leading and guiding children. As adults, we like to think that we're not really influenced by others' opinions, thoughts, and media messages, but nothing could be further from the truth. And children are even more influenced by those things. When someone tells us that we are better than other people for any reason, we like to believe that. And when we internalize messages about being superior or inferior, or that someone else is superior to us or inferior to us, it alters and changes the ways that we interact and behave in general. Within 15 minutes of receiving the messages that they were superior or inferior to another group, Elliot saw the marked differences in the kids' choices of behavior and language. As adults, we have to tune into our own hearts and minds to determine if we've received or if we're providing messages to others about superiority or inferiority in these ways. That includes experiences that we may have had that made us feel either way personally. Did I grow up with a family system that made me feel inferior or superior for anything related to stuff I don't choose? So physical qualities, size, height, weight, race, ethnicity, class, money, those kinds of things. Did I receive and take in messages about any type of external quality determining that somebody is better than somebody else, regardless of whether I'm on the better or worse side? Now, this is practical in terms of taking stock of what that means for us, but it takes a lot of work. It sounds like that being the, you know, a step to do. Hey, think about these messages and what happened for you as a person. These aren't things that just pop into your head. They're not things that you can just kind of think about in passing. It's really takes some quiet time of reflection, getting quiet and getting still and really thinking through messages that were shared with us as we grew up. It can be hard to tap into some of these because a lot of them are tied to memories, oftentimes memories that bring discomfort, whether we were on the receiving end or if we were taught to be afraid of other types of people. Did someone tell us that people were better than others because of their race, class, status, or other identifiers? Or were we told that they were more dangerous, that people were smarter or more attractive or safer than other people as a result of these? A lot of times we have to drop stories in our minds and remember things that happened And those don't feel great to remember a lot of times. And they can take a while to unpack. And so it's easy to run past this and to kind of just let it be going in the background. But if we're going to address these, and especially address things that we're not as aware of, unconscious things that are influencing the way that we engage with our kids and the way that we're teaching them about people groups and status and superiority and inferiority, we have to do the hard work ourselves. Now, can you do this on your own? Absolutely. You can take quiet time. Journaling is really great. Considering things, but every now and then you might run up against a bump and you might run up against something that brings more emotions than what you expected. Or you may have a really hard time drumming up some of these memories or thinking all the way through this, or it might feel really uneasy to you to do that. You might want to reach out and ask for help with that if that's the case. See a counselor for a few sessions and maybe work through this with someone else. Talk to a spiritual advisor or a mentor or somebody to help you consider these. Because messages about superiority and inferiority are not always as direct as Elliot's were to her classroom. In fact, they're more often very covert. Social and cultural practices, other adults' comments and language, and even the people that we choose to be around and choose for service. So friends and family members, but also contractors, professionals like our physicians and consultants or people that we use services from, share messages with our children regarding people's value, especially when it comes to visual identifiers like race. While this study has more applications than I could possibly unpack in a single episode, it was really designed to address racism and discrimination. And what we learned from Elliot's work about racism and discrimination is so relevant today. So I urge you as an adult to take stock of your word choices, your tone of voice, and the nature of your jokes, and your mindset about people who are different from you. What you say, and so often what you say when you're not thinking about things, sends messages to your kids about how to value or devalue other people when they're not meeting your expectations. And frequently, people who are different from us for a wide variety of ways, even when it's not wrong, fail to meet our expectations or can frustrate us, rub us in the wrong way, or give us content that we may think is funny to joke about. Consider how you speak about these things in the presence of your kids. Your conclusions and what you say, they may be your conclusions drawn as a result of experience and some of your life, but those become roadmaps that guide how your kids enter and engage with others from the beginning. So if you have been taught that certain people groups are to be feared or are not as helpful or not as safe, and you may not tell your kids that directly. You may not say this type of person or these types of people are a specific way, but you may be doing behaviors or saying things in the periphery that is absolutely sending those messages to your children in a way that you don't even intend. You may not even recognize it or be as tuned in to the messages that you're sending overtly or covertly. These are things that we have to tap into and be more aware of because we have to be intentional about the messages we want to send to our kids. We can tell our kids, we believe everyone is the same. We treat everybody the same way and we value everyone and this is part of our belief system. But if you then turn around and yell at someone on the road and get angry at them because and assign something to them as a people group, for example, you might tell your kids that we value everybody no matter what their status and situation is, but perhaps an elderly driver cuts in front of you and you start making biting comments about how older people shouldn't be allowed to drive. And in those moments and messages that you're sending, as we sometimes just kind of run our mouths, and we don't necessarily require ourselves to take stock of that and shut it down, we send messages to our kids about older people and how we value or devalue, including the idea that we have a better idea of what they should be allowed to do or not do. That then becomes roadmaps for our children in how they view and understand older adults. I see this happen often, where it might be an age group or a race group, and then parents are very confused as to why their kids are disrespectful to others in the same way, because they have always told them they're not allowed to be disrespectful, and they don't intentionally or mindfully disrespect, and yet there are things that are still being picked up. So this is another one, like the last episode, that really it's a focus on awareness and beginning to choose a mindset to lean into these areas and learn more, not just about content, but about our own processes. I encourage you to consider an active practice of finding ways to verbally speak well of those who are different from you, especially if you want your children to be open and be kind to others who are different from them. Intentionally engage in conversations with those who are different from you to learn more about their lives and experiences, just in small connective moments. And consider directly how you want your kids to learn from you about people who are different. For years and years, and I'll wrap up with this, we have valued and talked about multicultural competence in my profession of counseling. And there is some shifting and changing in that language that we are using. And there's a new term that we're beginning to incorporate more. It's so much more valuable to me. But we are starting to use language about cultural humility. And in my experience, this is really starting and moving in schools that have connections to faith-based and to spiritual concepts. Humility is a word that oftentimes is more valued in those, but that's not really where it originated. The idea of multicultural competence is that somehow we can be competent across a lot of cultures that are different from ours. It sounds like we can learn enough stuff to know enough things to be competent or at a level of functioning. As counselors, we know that that's really not how it works. I can't learn enough about any people group that when I approach another person, I understand them as a person in their experience. That's not possible, and it really is verbiage that gives us an unrealistic expectation, right? And so in counseling, we teach and we help others learn how to engage with their clients and with other people in general from a place of curiosity versus judgment, from a place of interest and a desire to know more, a desire to learn more, and with a starting point of, I know very little about your whole experience and I would love to know more about it. Cultural humility is, in brief, I could do a whole series on cultural humility. But cultural humility is more of a demeanor and a posture of saying the way that we're raised, the culture and environment that we're raised in, and that can be racial backgrounds and ethnic backgrounds, but it also can be geographical locations. It can be generational differences. It can be class and socioeconomic status and any other identifiers or things that put a lens on our life. The way that we're raised and the culture that we grow up in gives us an idea and an attitude about what is normal in life. And people from other cultures and backgrounds have a different baseline of what is normal. Cultural humility says, I don't know very much about what those are, but I am learning about mine so that I can understand more about others, and I will approach others in a way that tempers my idea of normal so that I can understand how you are in space when I am just connecting to you as a person. And so it's not so much of something to learn as it is a way of practice and a commitment to being. And if you want to know more about cultural humility, there's a lot of stuff out there on it. But it really starts and roots in people learning about their own cultures. Now, As a white female in the United States, that the first time somebody ever told me I need to learn about my own culture, it's like, what culture? Because when you're part of a dominant culture, it just seems like it really is the normal. But every single people group has cultural rules and expectations. And even within dominant cultures, there are so many differences. And getting in touch with those and understanding those, putting language to those, helps us to create a foundation to connect to others in a way that values and appreciates those differences, even without necessarily changing ours. So I encourage you to look more into that, to take this in and to value and appreciate the awareness of this and tune in to the messages that you're sending and reconnect to the messages that were sent to you so that you can make determinations of how you want this to go for your family in the future. Thank you so much for listening to Remodel Parenting. If you know someone who could benefit from this episode, I hope you'll share it with them. And if you love what we're doing, like and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you have topics you'd like to hear about, email us at info@theremodelproject.com.